Moncrief on News Talk.
Back in the 1980s, Susan Bluchild's parents' marriage broke down, which led to considerable financial hardship for her mother. She was a woman in her 40s, at a time when Ireland was still an economic basket case. Options were severely limited, so she became a dominatrix. Susan has a podcast telling this story called The Real Mistress Elaine and joins us now. Afternoon, Susan.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Yeah. So when your parents' marriage broke down, was that a kind of a gradual process that was happening in the house?
It was a gradual process since I was about the age of 8. I mean, there were arguments, and it was predominantly my mum that was causing the aggro. She was unhappy and frustrated, and a lot of it was due to financial difficulty, not being able to get a job for her.
Mm.
My dad still worked, but money was tight. And between the ins and outs of looking after a family, I was the youngest of three children. She was just completely at the end of her tether. And she had always done office work for years, as a lot of women of that generation did. And simply because she just could not get a job.
Yeah.
That's when she made this really life-changing, drastic decision.
And as I said, it was a very Irish separation in the sense everyone stayed where they were.
Everyone stayed where they were. Yeah. I mean, you know, they kept it all together. My dad, God love him, I mean, he didn't want to desert his family, and he's a very loyal, sincere man. So he went out to work, and they just went about, they were leading separate lives.
Mm,
I mean, I could see that, but at the same time, being 16, I was also quite young, that I didn't have enough understanding of human relationships and psychology that you could understand how two people were trying to live with each other, you know, as calmly as possible.
Yes, But you were the only one left in the house.
I was the only one left. They'd gone. I was the youngest there, yeah.
So, where did your mother get the idea from? Because it's not the first thing that would spring to your mind in Ireland of the 1980s.
Yeah. Well, she had lived in London since she was 18. That's where she'd met my father. She was living there for about 10 years. She met my dad literally within a month of moving there. And I mean, my dad's a very English, liberal English man. There was no Catholic type of religion. So you have to remember, he grew up in a very different type of society in London compared to here. She was always researching ideas. She was always reading. She was, you know, very heavy into books and psychology. And having lived in London and having been exposed to, I suppose, Soho, strip clubs, the West End of London, all these sorts of things, it wasn't anything particularly taboo or new to her. But seeing that there was just no kind of option, and reading a lot of, you'd always see British tabloid stories, especially on Sundays, like the News of the World. You'd see women who were maybe had gone into for survival. They'd gone into maybe doing BDSM work, and they didn't have to have sex. That was the fantastic thing about it. And, you know, put on a pair of boots and whip a few geezers on the backside and, you know, collect your money. And that was it.
Okay. How did she go about collecting her clients?
Well, what she did was she actually had an ad in a Contact magazine here. There was a couple of them in Northern Ireland and also the in Dublin. I mean, in those days, as you know, there was no internet. There was no any of this online portals. So it was the In Dublin magazine with the box number, and she put an advert in, you know, dominant mistress seeking submissive naughty boys, and the postman had to ring the bell because within a few weeks there was parcels full of letters that came to actually, you know, apply for the position. And of course, a lot of them thought it was just maybe for fun. But when she phoned them all, there was about 80 replies that came in the first load of envelopes. And I mean, as my mother always used to say, we had a big recession in Ireland in 1987 when this all started. But as she used to say, there's no recession when it comes to sex.
No, there never is. No, there never is. Did she have any process for screening them?
Yeah, she would phone them all. She told them there was a fee involved, and half of them, of course, weren't interested, whereas the other half were. They were all, you see, a lot of people, men that are into BDSM, tend to be very high up the ladder. So there were very sort of well-educated guys, like lawyers, corporate people.
Mm.
A lot of them were quite submissive and very easygoing. They wouldn't have done you any harm. So when she would speak to them, you could tell on the phone that they were genuine. And she was a very intelligent lady. And I mean, you know, you know your genuine human nature. You can gauge a lot from somebody's voice and mannerisms on a phone. So she organised the appointments daily between 12 and 2, and they were told to phone between 12 and 2 if they wanted the appointment. And they would come to the house sometimes between sort of 1 p.m. and 5 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all this time your father's still living in the house, but he's at work.
He's at work and he didn't know. Yeah.
No idea.
No idea. At the time he had no idea. He was suspicious. He knew that she was out socialising with her friends and trying to make a life. And I think my dad was really just there for us at that stage, you know, for the family and, you know.
Yeah.
But I think he just, you know, I mean, I only spoke with him last night before I came on today. And he said, look, partly it was my fault, Susan. I was always working. And, things were difficult and we were trying to make the best of it. And, you know, when you're young, Sean, you see two people and they're trying to achieve a balance. Yeah, but yeah, he didn't actually know, which was kind of strange for me because I thought, God, you know, if my dad knew. And, but like he only admitted to me all these years later that, you know, he knew there was something going on. Yes. He just
couldn't put his finger on it. Probably wouldn't have occurred to him it was that. And did your mother have to, did she learn on the job or how did that work?
She'd read a lot of the newspaper articles online, and there was one particular very famous London dominatrix at that time in the UK called Lindy Sinclair. And I think she'd managed to get some magazines she'd bought online or some paraphernalia, which kind of gave her some instruction. I have to point out, my mum was actually quite a domineering person. She had a very, very strong personality, okay, very feisty. So for her, like, it was just, you know, get across that chair, you bastard.
Yeah.
You know, and give them a few cracks of the whip. And sometimes they would tell her, look, would you cane me or would you just tie me up or just treat me like a little naughty schoolboy and you'll be my schoolmistress. And, you know, so it's not like she was totally unaware of how it might actually happen or
okay,
go.
All right.
You know?
Yeah. Though I suppose they would have requests beforehand of things they might like to do. And also, very cleverly, she would get some of them to kind of do
housework.
Housework. Yes, that's brilliant.
That's what I mean, I've seen
a cleaner and an income at the same time.
Somebody paying you to do your housework.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, as I said, I always say I came home from school one day and there she was, scantily clad through the sitting room window, and there was a partially naked man in a black thong doing the hoovering while she was lashing him on the ass. And I thought, oops, she's got a client in. I better go down to the local shop and get myself a can of Coke or something and borrow chocolate. Mum's got a client in. And I came back maybe 40 minutes later and I think he'd given her 50 or 60 quid for the best part of an hour to do the cleaning. And well, she gave him a few lashes on the arse.
Now, did she sit you down and tell you she was doing this work or how did you come to learn of it?
We were very close and I could see how the frustration was building up in the years building up to this. She couldn't get a job, you know, bid the bills, you know, everything between the. And she just sort of said that she started to tell me about the articles. She'd say, look at this in the News of the World or look at this. And I'd say, God, Mum, that's a great way to make money. And she just sort of said, look, I've had enough. I've had enough of this. And she actually told me a story that when she was about 14, she was walking down O'Connell Street one day with her mother because she was from the centre of Dublin. And her mother used to work in a cake shop in Kimmage back in the 1940s or 50s at weekends. And this young lady that used to work in the shop bumped into my grandmother and said, how are you? You know, what are you doing? She said, are you still in that cake shop? And she said, I am, yeah. And she said, what are you doing? Oh, sure, I'm just going off into the Gresham for the afternoon. She said, you know, I'm going to madaming. And she told this story to my mother and she said, what did she mean? And she said, well, what do you think she meant? You know, and I think it was just her thing to me was, I'm going to start doing this domination work. I'm going to do this kind of thing. She could see that there was money in it and
yeah. Okay. So she told you, and did she have to explain to you what it was?
No, because I mean, I was 16. I was interested in boys, as we all are. You know, we all had a healthy interest in the opposite sex. So, I mean, because she was telling me her plight and I felt very sorry for her. And I mean, could you imagine, you have to put yourself in someone's shoes that's, you know, married with children and can't get work. And I just understood. I was very open and I just understood. And I said, well, you know what, if there's no harm in it, and if people want to pay you a few bob and come round and you can do it discreetly, well, then, you know, I told, because she had no job. She could not get a job.
Yeah,
about it. The desperate people do desperate things.
And then in time, you kind of were helping a bit in kind of the catering. That's putting a vision in people's mind, but you were kind of serving them tea and stuff.
She used to have what she would call cross-dressers tea parties.
Right.
So this was something that she had. One guy came dressed as a woman. And he said, look, you know, you should be doing a little bit of kind of, he used to like to sit down at the table and she had very high standards. She had my grandmother's China tea set and she would set the table. And I said, like, why don't you get a group of them together, Mum? You could make like three times the money in the couple of hours. So she sent out a kind of word between the lot of them, look, maybe on this particular day of the week, I'm going to do a couple of hours. And if you want to meet a couple of other, you know, cross-dressers, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a little bit of a tea party and tea and cakes. So I actually assisted her setting the table with the China tea set, crackers and cheese, pastries. You know, she's very high standards.
Lovely.
You know, she loved, you know, hello, darling, you know. And they loved that.
And how long would it last for?
About 2 hours. Usually they'd be no more than three.
Mm.
So they'd come in very, they love to be feminine. So for them to be able to meet someone else who was also dressed as the similar, you know, they would all be talking in high pitched voices. I'd say, what's your name? Trish. I said, oh, hello, Trish, you're looking very glamorous today. You know, because she had these real airs and graces, my mum. She was obsessed with sort of English upper crust kind of aristocracy. I think this was all part of the whole kind of vision and scene that she wanted to promote. But like that, they would just sit there and they'd be three of them around the table. I'd serve the tea, set the tea, you know, China tea set, you know, help out and just have a chat with them. And they just, I think it was for them, it was so astounding that there was an opportunity for them to be sitting down with two or three other of their own.
To normalise it.
Yeah, to normalise it. And it was just so, oh my God, there's actually an opportunity here. This is a safe space.
Yeah. Know? And for the people who would come in then for the domination sessions, was there a period afterwards where they'd also sit down and have a cup of tea and you'd all talk
sometimes
about what was it like in the circuit court
well, they
today?
Would have been, they would have been a singular. Yeah. That would have been one at a time. Yeah, she'd often give them a coffee or a tea. She was very hospitable. So, you know, she'd always offer them a tea or a drink. And a lot of them just loved. They were lonely, Sean.
Yes,
you know, they just
yeah.
loved to. Where else could they do this? And a lot of them just would talk about maybe they were lonely in their marriages and maybe they couldn't live out this side of themselves. And maybe they asked the wife to dominate them and they refused. Mm. And here they could just have this opportunity just to, you know, and she was such an outgoing lady. And again, a great listener. You need to be, you know, you need to have empathy and understanding. So you were offering a kind of a service, like a counselling service, really, in a sense that,
yeah.
you know, these guys, you know, and I mean, people might think, oh, are they not dangerous kinds of people? They were the most normal kinds of people. They were well educated. They were lawyers.
Because I've read that before, actually, that men in very powerful positions like to go to see a dominatrix so they'll have at least relief from that.
That's
where they're
exactly,
completely, utterly powerless.
That's exactly yeah. what it is. I mean, they just want to be just, you know, down on their knees at your feet, a beautiful, tall, sexy woman in thigh-high boots or a great pair of legs and just, oh, and it's like a release, you know.
How long did your mother do it for?
Well, I was there till I was 19 and then I went off to London to pursue my own thing. So it kind of slacked off a bit once I was gone. I mean, she had regular clients on and off, so she didn't need to advertise. And my dad actually ended up getting a better job a couple of years later into the early 90s. And I think it all kind of came to a halt then. And I think she also felt she was 53. Maybe she'd had enough of it really to us in a point. But, you know, guys would still ring even years later. Oh, look, I'm such and such from years ago. And are you still doing it? And she said, no, look, I, you know, I've shut up shop and I'm not really doing anything anymore. But
I've hung up my whip.
Yeah, yeah. I've hung up my whip.
And your siblings had no idea this was going on either.
No, I mean, they were gone. They were gone from the house. So. Yeah,
and I assume they were told at some point.
I didn't tell one of them until about 20 years later. I just felt it was a very sensitive subject and it's not something I wanted to broach with them. But I did tell one of them and she was like, wow, like, is that not dangerous? And she knew nothing about it. And she just said, well, look, you know, if she, mum was a great lady and, you know, she was feisty and outgoing. And at the end of the day, if she could make a few bob for herself doing that, you know, I mean, I suppose, as they all say, the family jewels or the family secrets.
Yes. And also, it's kind of like the family business to a degree, because there's a kind of a twist in this.
There and, is,
and about your aunt, your mother's sister.
Yeah, that's
yes.
correct.
Yeah. What happened to her?
Well, approximately about, when was that? From 1987. So in 2000, and around the year 2000, my aunt had become divorced from her husband. She was left sort of fairly all right off. She had a nice home, but she went off out on holiday to Egypt. And like many a middle-aged woman in her mid-50s and not being really able to meet too many divorced people in Ireland at that time, she met an Egyptian toy boy. Who was 39, she was 50. She was, again, like my mother, she was a stunningly attractive looking woman and beautiful and classy and everything else. But met this Egyptian toy boy of 39 or 40 and only met him twice out there and then asked him, do they have a future together? And she was completely blinded by the love and the sex. And, oh, he said, yes, we do have a future. And she literally just went back out there after two trips out there and brought money out there. The idea was to build a house so she could run maybe a tourist B&B. And she took the best part of nearly 80,000 out over the next couple of years. She was completely ripped off. She was completely scammed. Everybody said, don't do it. Don't do it.
Oh, God.
And you couldn't talk to her. You were talking to a wall. And, you know, go out and have a bit of fun maybe twice a year, but don't take your money out there. So she actually took most of her savings out there and he died of a heart attack in 2005. Although a lot of us actually say maybe he didn't, because she was out there 6 months of the year and 6 months here. And what happened was he never registered the house in her name. It turned out he had an arranged marriage to a younger girl with a couple of children whom he claimed weren't his. I mean, it was all lies.
Oh, God.
Very, very sad story. But she struggled for the next 7 or 8 years. I mean, she was going back out there paying money for lawyers to see if she could fight her case. She had no chance. I mean, there was just no paperwork, no nothing. And she was working as a carer for the elderly, literally for minimum wage, the best part of, what, 10 euros an hour. And her health wasn't that great. She was in her mid-60s at this time and still stunningly beautiful and attractive. And I just said to her, you know what, would you not think about doing something maybe spanking a few guys? And she said, what do you mean? Now, she wasn't a prude. She was, you know, she was a well-read woman. And I told her. I just said, you know, like, oh, you know, I know of people that might do that kind of thing and you could make a bit of extra money on the side because, you know, you're really struggling and your health's not great. And she used to do 3 days a week with an elderly man. She'd stay in his house in Dublin and care for him staying overnight. And then she'd be very tired when she'd get home. And I think that was her only source of income. And she, you know, she still had a small mortgage, what was left of her home and money. But money was just so tight. So I just told her. I had to broach it step by step. But I told her and I said, like, well, I have something to have to tell. Mum was actually doing this back in the late 80s. And she said, really? And it wasn't so much of a shock. And she just said to me that she said, all I can tell you is that your mother used to say to me, I did things you knew nothing about. I did things you knew if you knew what I did. And she said, well, now I know. And I said, well, you know, you don't have to live like this. I said, I don't want to have to think that you'd be doing something like this at the age you're at. But I said, you could get out of a hole here. And so I said, you know, you have the personality, you have the looks, you have the whole lot. Stick on a pair of boots and just put an ad up and see what happens. So we put it online, an advert. And I said, look, I'll sit with you. It's been a long time since I've kind of had any involvement in this, but I'll sit with you and we'll go through everything. And I sat with her for the next 5 days. I went up to her house every day and the phone rang off the hook. Absolutely just rang. I mean, there were men ringing up saying, I've been waiting years to meet a woman like you. You know, because I mean, I think a lot of men in that age group in the sort of 60s, who a lot of them would have been widowed or divorced or just totally leading a separate life from a very long marriage. An awful lot of that, Sean, was company. They just wanted a woman to talk to, because she had a fantastic personality. She was a great listener. That's what an awful lot of these men want. You know, a lot of men will always say they don't feel like they're listened to by women. But I can tell you, it was the greatest counsellors on earth were taking place there.
And I suppose a lot of them, if they would have been in their 60s, you don't want to have a session with someone who's young enough to be your daughter. That gives you the ick. I know in the context that sounds weird, but
But BDSM is predominantly performed by a mature woman. You're not going to have a 21-year-old, you know, doing that. So there was this mature woman who'd had life experience and was a very interesting person and had lived. And that's really what predominantly the connection was about, you know. And but she got the boots on and just gave him a few cracks of the whip, or had the, again, cleaning the house, you know, hoovering and doing the polishing, and she was getting paid. And she actually made Sean some wonderful men friends.
And so did she keep the carer's job while she was still doing dominatrix work?
She still kept the carer's job, but on less hours. And she just maybe used to see maybe 5 or 6 people a week, not every week, but a lot of it was the cross-dressing as well. A lot of younger guys who love to cross-dress and, you know, the older woman, that was a big thing, like what my mother did with the transvestite tea parties.
Yeah.
But they were crazy about her, absolutely crazy about her.
And how many years did she do that for?
She did it for about 3 years. One of the men that she met, a widower in his 60s, who was quite comfortably off, they fell in love.
Ah, no.
Yes. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that so lovely? After what happened, an abusive first marriage, an Egyptian toy boy who ripped her off, and this wonderful man who, he always said they never would have met. They never would have met.
And was that happily ever after?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And sadly, she passed away a few years ago as well, not too long ago. But that was just, he was the loveliest man. I had many a wonderful conversation with
him. And have you written a film script about this?
Yeah, I'm a script writer and an actress and a singer. And I've just developed a TV comedy drama about it with a screenwriter friend of mine.
Yeah.
So that's why I've created the podcast to get the word out. I've had so many people saying to me, oh my God, when's the TV show on?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to see
this. Absolutely.
Because everyone said to me, like, I was at a writer's group in London a few years back. And when I told them, they were like, what? You've got to tell your story. You know, And the interesting thing is, Sean, you know, it's all about the relationships between the mother, daughter and the aunt. It's all the whole intricacies of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, yes, there probably was some impact between all of our different personalities, me at 16 and then later on when I brought it to my aunt. But yes, we've written a TV pilot for this as a comedy drama. So hence the podcast.
Wow, that's a hell of a story, Susan. Thanks a million for coming in to tell us about it. That was Susan Bluechild there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.